Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 19th, 1999, and in Koina, near Creekside Room this evening is John Marty's session called Gun Control in the Wake of the Columbine High School Shooting. Let's listen in.
In light of the Columbine High School shooting, what it's, what the current situation means for the issue of gun control and what's likely to happen and so on. And because of the nature of this type of topic, what I'm hoping to do is to leave more time than usual at the end to have a sort of open forum, open discussion on thoughts and ideas, whether you support gun control, if so, types of gun control you support, and then two, what the politics are from your perspective of it. But I want to start out by going through those same things from my perspective on it and talking about how I feel about it and why, and then open it up for discussion and debate or disagreement, whatever. In any case, one statistic that I always thought is a good way to get started on explaining the reason gun control is a hot issue, which it always is in our country, is the statistic one group puts out in the form of a poster in 1996. Handguns killed 2 people in New Zealand, 15 in Japan, 30 in Great Britain, 106 in Canada, 211 in Germany, and 9,390 in the United States. We're obviously a bigger population than like New Zealand and Japan, but nevertheless, the number of is a percentage of the population. The number of gun homicides in our country is about 8 times the average of other industrialized countries. There can be lots of factors for that. Not necessarily easy availability of guns, though that is certainly part of it. People often talk about guns being kept in an unsafe society. We need guns to protect ourselves. Guns kept in a home for self-protection are 43 times more likely to kill a family member or friend than they are to be used to kill somebody else in self-defense. Can argue, well, maybe they don't even come and attack you if they know you've got a gun. But households with guns are about triple the risk of homicide of other households, not just gun homicide, but all kinds of murder, are about triple the rate of other households. Yet despite the high gun crime rates, we're one of few, and I think we may be the only of the industrialized countries, which depending on how you define it, I think it's about 30 countries or so, that does not require a license to have gun ownership. And I think everybody here knows the nature of this issue is such that it is a hot issue. And it tends to be acted on after a particularly violent situation. The first gun control law we had in this country of any sort, which banned machine guns, was in 1934. And I think there, the two basic reasons something passed at that time, one was prohibition era violence, and number two was the attempted assassination of FDR. I think it was before he was actually sworn into office, but after he was elected. But that spurred it, and again, the nature of what they did, banning machine guns. I wasn't around then, but the pictures I saw, the stories I've heard, the movies we see about gang violence in the Prohibition era showed machine guns as something they had, and that was the reaction at that time. 1968 was the next major gun control effort or law passed at the federal level. That was on the heels of a lot of urban violence and rioting in 65, 66, 67, and in 68, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. Violent tragedies are often a catalyst for people trying to do it. After Columbine High School shooting several months ago, there's talk about how do we respond, and among the responses are reducing violence in the media, gun control, several other means of doing this. And in this, getting for a second to the politics of it, public opinion is clearly divided on the issue, but a fairly sizable majority. In politics, a landslide is about 60%, and about 70% of Americans favor stricter gun laws, including a majority of those who own guns. And now it's about 1 in 4 Americans own guns, but there are about 230 million guns in the country, which is almost one gun for every citizen. I think there are about 275 million people in current population and 230 million guns. Almost one gun per person, but only 1 in 4 people has a gun. But even among the 1 in 4 who do own guns, 57% do favor stricter gun laws. But again, the nature of, even if it's 90% who oppose, that still leaves obviously some on the other side. And the politics of gun control are such that the side that opposes them feel extremely strongly about this. Maybe both sides feel strongly about it, but the side that opposes gun controls have electoral clout because of one factor, and that is that they will often vote. That is the most salient issue for them in voting, or one of 2 or 3 issues, and therefore the so-called single issue voter has more clout. If I tell you that I'm going to vote against you because of this issue, I don't care where you stand, I can agree with you on everything else, but this issue, I'll vote against you. You know, in a political race, 1% is the difference between winning and losing, and if 2 or 3% are going to vote on a single issue against you because of something, that can sway the difference in a close race. And the NRA has sizable amounts of money to put into campaigns, plus the electoral clout of single issue voters. So even if more than 2-to-1 margin favors stricter gun laws, including a majority of gun owners, nevertheless, it may be partly reality, partly sense of what the reality is. A whole range of things can create the political fear to address the issue, and as a result, it has not been majority opinion direction, but there's been easing of gun laws. Minnesota is not unique. I think we're fairly similar to most other states in this. There's been a big movement to pass concealed carry laws. In our state, in order right now, if you want to carry a handgun, you have to, if you're not law enforcement, the only 2 exceptions are if you have personal safety need or an occupational need to carry a gun. And that's determined by the local law enforcement chief, the police chief, the county sheriff in rural areas, and they have the choice. They can, if you meet the qualifications, you can't be a violent felon, you can't be mentally ill and have been committed for it, you can't be under age 18, you can't have certain other things, but if you meet those tests and you can say, I either have a personal safety need or occupational need, then they can give you a permit. Concealed carry law, the difference from what we have would be if you meet these tests and you say, I need it for personal safety, there's a lot of violence out there in the street, I might get killed, therefore I need a gun for personal safety, then law enforcement is required to give you one if you meet those other tests. That's the difference between the concealed carry law states and the others that aren't. There's been a growing number of states that have allowed this. Minnesota's been debating this for about 2 or 3 years now, and I guess that they're within a couple of votes in the legislature of getting it through. There's also been laws, I'll use Minnesota as an example here. Again, I'm more familiar with our own state's efforts. There have been laws to exempt gun clubs from local noise and zoning laws. Why that? Because in metropolitan areas, there's growing population, new suburban developments, an area where there might be a gun range. They're now saying, look, you don't meet noise things, you don't meet zoning things, so they're saying you don't properly exist here, so we're going to zone you out of existence. And they're complaining about that, so there have been things saying, doesn't matter what your hours of use are, even if you're surrounded by housing, if you want to start 7 in the morning, go till 11 at night, the local community has no control over that. That almost passed our house last year. There have been many states, not Minnesota, but a number of states have passed and others have considered laws that ban local governments from suing gun manufacturers. I think it's New Orleans, Chicago, one of the big cities in Pennsylvania is suing gun manufacturers for for liability for selling dangerous products. I don't think you could sell one. I mean, you couldn't sue an auto manufacturer for a dangerous product because their cars get involved in accidents. But the times you do have it is when there's not meeting some standard of liability that is out there. You know, if a faulty seatbelt, if you have faulty something else, the car tends to roll easier, you can sue them over that. The proposals for suing gun manufacturers have ranged from the ones that don't do anything, use any new technologies that could prevent kids from using them, smart technology that's now available. And in Chicago, one of the things is, in Chicago, there's a ban on handgun ownership, and they've documented is for their lawsuit a number of suburban gun shops who are buying without making any attempt to find out if they're selling to Chicago residents right on the edge of the city, and arguing that with any other product, a manufacturer has to take some due care to make sure that they are not selling a dangerous product in a way that's a violation of the law. But there have been a number of efforts in various states, some of them successful, to ban local governments from suing gun manufacturers. And most of the attempts to increase gun control, even after Columbine, have been very modest changes. The debate in the federal government has been very trivial, I would guess, to many people since. There was a debate, how long should the waiting period be if you want to buy a gun for a background check? The gun show or something, you want to have a background check, should it be 24-hour waiting period or 72-hour or 3 business day or what should it be? I frankly think most of the public, when they favor gun control or they oppose gun control, hey, we don't want to have any background check, or yeah, we want to have a background check, and if it takes 3 weeks to get it done, we want 3 weeks waiting period. I think the public generally sees it as kind of petty bickering of kids, the way the political debate, maybe they feel that way about all issues, but the differences between the two sides here tend to be fairly modest in terms of the direction. There have been proposals for more, rather than gun control, control of who has access to guns and for what purpose, to gun safety. Trigger locks, adult liability for kids who have access to it, which is always interesting. Minnesota, among other states, have passed a law saying if you're an adult and your kids get access to your gun and you didn't exercise due care, like you don't have them locked, you don't have them unloaded, kid gets them and kills somebody or kills a sibling or whatever, you are criminally liable for doing that, which I can see some arguments in favor of, and I think I've seen some of the people who have opposed gun control is in general supporting those things, though it does come always at a tragic time. A parent who's, there have been several cases where parents who've lost one of their kids to some other kid, killing them or something, and then they're being charged criminally after they've lost a child already. But the nature of attempts to deal with this has been fairly small steps forward, generally with the idea, well, we could never pass something more bold than that, so let's try modest steps. Of course, after Columbine and the major push for a number of these modest steps, nothing passed anyway, so much for the idea, you take a small step and you'll get somewhere. In terms of, I'm going to quickly go over my comments on the direction I think one should go in this, my position on it, then make some predictions about the future, which is always risky, and then open it up for discussion. First of all, I am convinced, one, that stricter gun laws would reduce violence. I don't know that the 9,390 handgun deaths in the U.S. 2 years ago is going to be dropped down to the same rates, which would be maybe 1,000 or so that the other industrialized countries would have for the same size population. I do think they will reduce violence, but I think if you think it's going to eliminate violence, no, it's clearly not the case. I think if you look at the number of people who have been blocked from getting guns under state versions of it or the federal Brady law with the background checks, when they say, well, this many thousands of people in California have been barred from getting guns, a lot of them are going to get guns eventually anyhow, but the person who is angry over a fit of divorce, something going on in their household, something like that, the delay in getting them may make it something where fewer people do. And I guess I think if you look at other countries which have much stricter forms of gun control, the 8-to-1 margin in number of, over 8-to-1 ratio of Americans getting killed by guns would go down. Whether it would ever match them, again, our history, our culture is different than other countries. So I was going to say, if I had one single thing that I would do to prevent crime, it would be the issue of the ounce of prevention being worth a pound of cure. That means prevention, early intervention. California, about close to a decade ago now, had a couple of counties had gone into a project in which they did chemical health, chemical dependency, mental health screening and intervention for troubled kids. You know, you take the kids who are in the court system, either for minor things like shoplifting or more serious offenses, you screen them, find out what's wrong. And not surprising, most kids who are in trouble with the law have something going on wrong, often from dysfunctional families, often chemical, alcohol, drug problems. They're very, very troubled kids in many cases. Intervening earlier, making sure what find what their problems are, and then intervening to make sure they get help they need. Not just saying, oh, we'll send you to this program, as courts often do, and not do any real follow-up to see what happens. Even among the offenders, the pool of offenders in this county in California that had tried this, they found a 50% reduction in their repeat offense rate for kids who had gone through this program. 50%, we're talking about right now in the country, can we bring it down a little bit or stop it from going up with crime rate? 50% reduction is massive reduction. And I'd suggest that we ought to be doing that. That's costly to intervene, but it's a lot cheaper than letting the crimes occur responding afterward. But back to the issue of gun control. I guess I would argue that the piecemeal law approach that we've had in the past, you know, if somebody prohibition era violence, we go after the machine guns. They have a couple of drug gang killings now with a lot more use of the military style semi-automatic assault weapons. Semi-automatics being the things you have to pull the trigger separately each time, whereas in a fully automatic, you just pull the trigger in it, machine gun. But by approaching laws with the, here's the concern of the day and here we'll respond to that, I think it creates fairly large loopholes. And let me suggest one example of how those loopholes occur. Minnesota's had a ban on private ownership of gun silencers for a long time. And several years ago, some people came in and said, you know, we need to exempt Minnesota firearms dealers from the ban on silencers, because how else can they sell it to law enforcement who need silencers? Well, the law enforcement community wasn't asking for it. We've talked with a number of them. They didn't say they wanted it. They said they didn't know of any law enforcement agencies that had them or that used them. One guy said, well, the head of our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension said he could picture, he couldn't picture, but he said if somebody was saying that law enforcement needed, maybe they were thinking that, you know, a SWAT team might want to be able to shoot out a streetlight in a night stakeout or something and be able to do it. But he had never heard of any Minnesota SWAT teams using them and didn't know why somebody would. And silencers are something, I mean, all the TV movies have them, and clever thing to have. But, well, who wanted it? Why the request for the exemption? Well, those who are interested in the exception know that one of the ways around lots of the gun laws, the way we have them set up in the country, is to become a gun dealer. Now, until 1994, one of the federal gun control things made it a little bit tougher and more expensive to become a federally licensed firearms dealer. But until that time, there was an average of almost 5,000 gun dealers per state. It's now been reduced to about 3,000. Well, how many car dealers are there in a typical state? I keep thinking of our yellow pages, how many car dealers we have in the Twin Cities, Minnesota metropolitan area, which is 2/3 of the state's population. I don't think we have 150 car dealers in that area. What do we have? Statewide, 300, maybe 400 car dealers. It's 3,000 gun dealers. I mean, that's like as common as convenience stores. If you look in the yellow pages, you won't find these. They don't advertise because they're not really in the market of selling guns. They are firearms dealers because you can. It's an easier way to get them, and some of our laws exempt firearms dealers from a lot of things like that. And apparently, and what the other example on the silencers was, well, we ought to be able to have them as collector's items, because a lot of people collect guns, so we need to collect. There shouldn't be current silencers, so you can get them. We need to collect them as curiosity or antiques, and they're very expensive and valuable. Well, my proposal on gun control is, rather than continuing the direction we've been doing, I happen to like the idea, and it's considered a radical one in some circles. I think it's fairly modest and reasonable, but that is to treat cars the way we treat guns, the way we treat cars. Both products have a number of lawful uses. They can also be extremely dangerous. We require training of all things to drive a car. We require licensure of drivers, car owners, registration of those vehicles, and we register them to whoever owns them. We limit on how they're used, speed limits, drunk driving laws. Those who break the laws have their privileges taken away. And in Minnesota even, I think it takes 3 offenses now, but after a third time DWI offense, you can lose your car. You actually forfeit the car. Deer shining is first offense, which may say something about our DWI laws and the status of what our priorities are. It's easier to protect the deer, but nevertheless, you can lose your car for violating the law, and certainly lose your privileges. My argument was treat guns the same way, and because of the nature of the issue, I'd suggest prohibit license fees being used. They're not trying to raise revenue to build roads here. Prohibit revenues from being any more than sufficient to establish a licensure system. And obviously, and here's where the big controversy comes about, is, oh, who's going to get access to that? If everybody knows who has the guns and who doesn't, then the people without guns are going to be less safe and so on, because they'll come break into their houses. I think, well, if people have the right to own a gun, then frankly, that's the case. But make sure this is private data, which is not accessible to anyone other than law enforcement. Minnesota has a lot of privacy laws like that for certain types of government data, and it is enforced, and it lasts that way. But nevertheless, the lines you hear are, first thing they do is they register our guns, next thing they do is take them away. And again, with cars, once upon a time, we didn't license drivers and register vehicles. We've changed that over the years, and again, the only time I know where government confiscates cars is for serious law violations, and I think I'd rather have that same situation for guns. Register all guns to their owners, track gun transfers. Again, one of the big issues, one of the loopholes was the private gun shows. A lot of people at gun shows are firearms dealers. There are a lot of firearms dealers, but not everyone is. And you can buy guns through the want ads, you can buy them from gun shows, and if you're not buying, and this includes in Minnesota and most states, I believe, if you buy from a private party, there's no background check of any sort, which suggests if you create that kind of loophole, then, you know, if you're the person who doesn't care much about abiding by the law, you have a violent criminal record, you're not going to be able to buy from a licensed dealer, so you buy them through a gun show or some other way. I think there should be a lifelong loss of license for violent crime convictions. It was interesting, several years ago I had a bill that was being pushed by, there had been a number of domestic abuse, people who were battering their spouse, and went in and shot him later. And the proposal was to say if you were convicted of domestic abuse, you could not own a gun for 5 or 10 years. And I brought that in committee, and I said how I thought anyone who committed any kind of violent crime shouldn't have a right to have a gun, and how I thought that was kind of the NRA's line, that deal with the criminals, not with the law-abiding citizen. And, you know, here we're talking about the criminals. Let's deal with them toughly. One of the members of the committee who happened to be an NRA member said he agreed with that, and he offered an amendment to take away guns from anyone convicted of any violent crime, and it passed unanimously. We passed it unanimously on the Senate floor, and only then did gun lobby decide that was outrageous what was happening, and they killed it in the House. But I do think that somebody who you lose certain rights, and the goal of, I mean, there are two goals of the criminal justice system in punishing people. One is to punish them, the other is to protect public safety. And whether you call it punishment or protecting public safety, I think it clearly does protect public safety to keep guns away from felons even after they're out of prison. But I would argue that unless we set up this kind of infrastructure on regulation of guns, which is extremely controversial, though I think the polls say the public would support it, unless you set up this infrastructure, you're going to have loopholes. And again, that doesn't mean you're going to eliminate all crime. It doesn't mean you're going to stop anybody who is desperate to get a gun from somehow getting them. But the proposals out there to ban, call them Gun of the Month Club, ban purchase of more than one gun a month, which are highly controversial, but it passed in a number of states. It stops the people who go in the gun running business where they buy 20 guns in a state like Virginia, go and ship them to New York where you're not allowed to buy them as easily and sell them quickly. And there's good money to be made in that business if we ban people from purchasing more than one gun per month. It makes it a little bit harder for the gun running business to exist and easier to prosecute. And again, if you register weapons, it makes crime after the fact, makes it easier to find out who had it. If I have a gun and it's used in a crime, you're going to find out very quickly, trace it back. Did I sell it to somebody? Whose gun was it? If it's mine, was it stolen? Oh, I didn't notice it was stolen. Well, maybe you start checking the people I know. If the gun's not registered in any way, shape, or form, you don't have that first step. It's not going to make arrest foolproof by any means, but it will help in some cases in apprehension of criminals. This proposal is much less modest than debate over whether background checks should last 24 hours or 72 hours. But again, I think the public does see those as political petty bickering. I would argue politically it's probably easier to get something that the public thinks might make a difference rather than something they think isn't going to really change the way things are. Then before opening it up for questions, discussion and comments, debate, whatever, the nature of what's going to happen in the near future. If I look at the past, how many months ago was Littleton? 4 months ago now. There have been, those school shootings seems to happen once or more a year now. Littleton was much worse than some of the other ones. But in the last month or so before I came here, I mean, there was an Atlanta stockbroker who was distraught, killed his family, and then started shooting out others. The shootout at that Jewish community center in Los Angeles. It is tragic incidents like this that fuel support for this. The U.S. Congress got tied up in the bickering over the little things, and the political momentum subsides. Littleton is not every day in the news. They look at the papers the week of Littleton, full-page stories on it and talking about Minnesotans who have connections to Columbine High School, a principal elementary school in that district and had ties to Minnesota. So they talk about her and how her kids went to school there and how scared she was. All that sort of thing, cover of Time, Newsweek, U.S. News type of things, that fades now. It's been many months behind, and the public viability, the interest in the issue fades, and therefore public pressure to do something about it changes. But I do think several of the presidential candidates, Elizabeth Dole, Bill Bradley, others have talked at least somewhat more than in the past issues that politicians have tended to duck. They've been talking about this issue. I think they feel it has a chance of support, and they can read the polls, and they realize that if they can get people excited about it, they have majority support for their position on that. But my prediction would be that there's not going to be a landslide overnight turnaround on the issue. I think that it's going to be continuing slow change in the laws. I think there will be a few more weakening of laws, but I think the trend is definitely going to be, I would guess we will have licensure registration sometime in the next 10, 15 years. But that's only a guess. It partly depends on, you know, I've seen how crime goes as a political issue in the polls. What's the most important issue to you? Economy usually tends to be number one. Education can go there, but you have one or two violent crimes in a community, in a state. I remember that happened about 6 or 7 years ago in Minnesota, two rural rape and murder situations 6 months before the election. Parents of one of those kids has been here at Holden Village, incidentally. That year, crime was the number one issue in Minnesota elections. Not just gun control, but a whole range of how are you going to address crime. And I do think that we're not going to have no more school shootings. We're not going to have no more stockbrokers going crazy or whatever. And therefore, I have a feeling we will have tighter laws coming, but I don't think it's going to be an overnight thing. With that, I hope I've given enough to stimulate a good discussion. And I would hope that we can do it in the nature of talking about the politics about it and the policy, because I think both of these are, in this issue, very much intertwined, because you can't really discuss the politics of this. You and I could sit down and discuss what we think makes the most sense to do in the issue. You could get 4 million Minnesotans, 270-some million Americans to sit down. Here's what we agree ought to happen. But that's the politics of this issue are very hot, and it doesn't work that way as it does with other issues. So I'd like to hear feedback and comments and direction you think we ought to go. In the back.
Yeah, when you talk about gun control and registration, what guns? Is it BB guns? Is it air rifles? Is it 22s? Or is it high-powered? What type of guns would be registered?
Right.
Whatnot.
Well, my own proposal was to didn't include air rifles. I used our existing state laws on guns. I included long guns. I included shotguns and rifles as well as handguns. Most gun laws in most states, including Minnesota, have been strictly on handguns. We ban in Minnesota, and I believe in federal law, though I'm not sure how tight it is, ban on sawed-off shotguns or short-barreled shotguns and rifles. But otherwise, fully automatic guns have been prohibited since the 30s, as I said. But most of our laws in Minnesota, and I think most other states, they ban the cheap handguns, the Saturday Night Specials, the semi-automatic military-style assault weapons, and the copycats of them. Most laws in most states do not touch any hunting long guns, rifles, and shotguns. But I included our definition in Minnesota law of those in my proposal.
John, any gun that kills a person or maims a person seems to be, to me, the same thing as an automobile. All of them can maim or kill. And we have laws, we don't have special laws governing certain types of cars. So why not all guns? If you're a hunter, then you have got to pass have training.
Training, and that's why I think, under our law, there may be some air guns or Daisy BB guns. Are those covered? I don't think they're covered under our law. 22s, everything, the whole range of them, I think we should treat that way for the nature of it. We don't say, frankly, the federal government does treat safety standards for minivans and light trucks differently than they do for automobiles, though people ride minivans and pickups the same way they drive automobiles. And the safety standards probably should be the same. My approach is that, yes, we should basically treat a gun as a gun. The big heat comes from Minnesota, like many other states, a very heavy percentage of people hunt. And I don't want to have all this. And my proposal, and the tough things about doing this is how do you deal? I've never been a big one on the banning of all gun ownership. First of all, how in the world do you get the guns? There are 230 million out there. But my proposal was that you'd grandfather in existing owners from the training. We're not going to take some 60-year-old guy who's been hunting his whole life and say, you got to go through firearms training in order to be licensed. So you give him a year or whatever from when the bill takes effect. That's the initial license period. If you have a gun, in that period you can get licensed as long as you pass the criminal background.
There's one problem I have, and I'm not a hunter. When I was trained, and then when I went to aim it at a live animal, a bird or something, I almost passed out. I couldn't hit something that was alive. That has nothing. I have these two guns that were from the family, someplace in the house, hidden. I have no idea where they are, and they're not registered. So I suppose I should be registering or getting rid of them.
I don't know of any state that has full, and maybe somebody can correct me if they're from a state that does it. I don't know of any state that does require registration licensing of guns and gun ownership.
The problem that we had when I lived in southern Idaho, there was a lot of hunting, and we were in the country. And things of this sort, this was back in the 70s, and things of this sort happened frequently. A little girl was standing at the roadway waiting for the school bus, and a gun or a bullet ricocheted and came back in her direction and killed her. And this sort of thing went on a great deal at that time, and we were all very upset because people could walk behind our alfalfa patch, as we call them, on the other side of the irrigation ditch with their guns. And we were in a section that had a number of homes in it along the road. We just had a few acres each. And yet these hunters were allowed to pass around this section and shoot anything that was within range, which meant our horses too. Mm-hmm. And we didn't like that sort of thing.
Well, by the way, the nature of the gun issue is such that it's very tough dealing with any of the regulations. There was one bill that didn't get anywhere about 20 years ago in Minnesota because it got ridiculed so much, but a guy, legislator, wanted to give free hunting licenses to the blind because they were disabled.
Oh, no.
He said, you know, they could have somebody point out where to shoot, you know. That got ridiculed and it never became law. But I was going to say that in safety issues like that, well, the heat is such, people, politicians wanting to please the people who feel strongest about this. It's very much, how do we make sure they're happy? There was an attempt in Minnesota to pass a constitutional right to hunt and fish. And whoever put it together was not a constitutional scholar, but they knew certain words to use. There shall be a fundamental right that shall not be in any way, shape, or form abridged to it's a valued heritage and so on. And it ended up, we passed something that was much more watered down about how it's a important part of our heritage and therefore it should be respected or something. But the initial bill, when I first saw it, it came out of a committee. It had already passed like one or two committees with saying it shall not be in any way, right to hunting fish is a fundamental right that shall not be abridged in any way, shape, or form. And except as to control based on season. Didn't have anything about species, which meant by my reading, you could probably shoot cats and dogs, because it was a fundamental right. I got an opinion from the Attorney General on what this thing would mean. It had nothing about where you could hunt, nothing about hours you could hunt. And I live in a suburban community, and shooting, I don't think most people think the local park should be, people should be shooting at 4 in the morning. But it prohibited, it spelled out the one or two things. It could do it by the season, and one other thing. But otherwise, they had passed two committees with maybe a dissenting vote or two, a bill that would prohibit any regulation based on species or based on other things. Part of the reason that bill failed in the end was the Attorney General wrote a letter, a memo on the issue, which he talked about how, you know, somebody could argue that for environmental reasons, that if you were to put in a new paper mill in northern Minnesota, the air pollution from the paper mill might destroy habitat and therefore some of the species, and that would infringe on this fundamental right to hunt and fish. And the author of the bill was from northern Minnesota, who hates any restrictions on paper mills, was scared all of a sudden it might do that. But again, the nature of a girl in a residential setting getting shot, that's one of the arguments I think we ought to make sure we have strict hunting while intoxicated laws. Minnesota now does, and training. I don't think politically you'd ever dare try and go back and train the existing pool, but 10 years from now, the kids who are 20, 25 years old and are out hunting, if they've had to go through a firearms training safety thing, I think that's a minimum we ought to expect. They're dealing with a deadly tool, deadly item, instrument, just the same way you are if you put a kid in a car without training. And I think we ought to do that, but you're never going to stop all of those. If we want to have hunting in communities, which is very near residential areas, Minnesota has one every year, every couple of years, where somebody's shot, a bullet, stray bullet goes through a house and causes problems.
Doesn't Minnesota have a law that before you can get a hunting license, you have to pass a...
If you are under 14 or 16, you have to pass an approved firearms course. But if you start, or I think you're allowed to with a parent or an adult without going through. But if you're, otherwise you have to undergo that. But if you get your license, if you want a hunting license when you're 18 or 17 or older, you don't need any training for that.
South Dakota, you have to go through hunter safety if you're a minor before you can get a license, and then. So even if you want to go out hunting with your parents, you still have to get that safety card. Are there laws about transporting firearms across state lines? I'm just kind of curious because in the last year, the people in our area, especially Highway Patrol, the FBI, and others were quite concerned because the gangs were starting to get organized even in rural northeast South Dakota. And they were aware of a bunch of guns that had come in, the handguns from Portland or Tacoma or someplace over here on the west coast that had come in northeast South Dakota, and they were really afraid that there was going to be a lot of shooting going on because of that.
One of the troubles with laws barring guns from various states, because guns aren't registered and so on, it's very hard to track them. Some that come directly from a gun dealer and there's a large quantity of them seized somewhere by somebody who's not supposed to have them, or illegal activity and so on, they may be able to trace by serial number, these all came from this part of, from a gun dealer in this part of the country. They may be able to track that much, but I don't know that there's any federal laws banning importing, crossing state lines with guns, and frankly, hunters do a lot of that, but usually not for purposes of sale. Since the Kennedy assassination, I think mail order firearms have been banned. At least most guns you can't buy mail order since '68, I think.
What about over the internet?
That's a new problem. There's a ton of them being sold by internet, I think.
The state law in Massachusetts says illegal for anyone other than a licensed firearm dealer or mail to transport a gun into Massachusetts.
So if I was hunting from New Hampshire, I could not cross.
You cannot bring your New Hampshire. You cannot bring your gun in without having a dealer transport it across the state line.
That's probably one of very few states that have that. I'm guessing.
One of the arguments I've heard from people that are against gun laws is that, like in Littleton, all of those guns were illegal anyway. All they need to do is enforce the laws they've got.
I think in the Littleton case, most of the guns were illegal to be possessed by a 15, 16-year-old kid.
Some were illegal in some circumstances.
I don't know.
A girl bought the guns
for
them.
Boyfriend who was not able
to be allowed to sell them to somebody who was legally allowed to. And again, my whole point is your comment is exactly right. A lot of our gun laws we don't enforce well because you can't really enforce because you have a pool of 275 million people and 230 million guns. Nobody has any track of where anything is, and the only thing we have is certain prohibitions. You, because of your age or because of your criminal background or because of this, you cannot own this type of gun or that type of gun. In Minnesota, we single out handguns and semi-automatic things, and certain people can't buy certain things. And
Felon can't buy a gun. That's federal law.
Right.
That's
old federal law too.
Yeah, about cutting off the barrel of 18 inches is a limit on any weapon other than a pistol, but you can't have a shoulder stock on a pistol. The fellow that they went at, FBI went after in Idaho, they got him for cutting off a barrel at 18 inches, which they told him to cut off. I'll admit the guy was a nut, and he shouldn't have done it, but I mean, it goes to show you that when they want to get somebody, it seems they can, but they simply do not enforce. In the state of Washington, felons buy hunting license and guns and go hunting all the time.
Felons buy hunting license?
You bet they do, and that's illegal, but they do not prosecute these fellows.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is they don't have space in the jails for them. And a lot of it's simply that maybe they don't care. I don't know.
I was going to say the combination of felons with guns is something that I think we ought to be pretty concerned about.
I think that's more serious than putting people in jail for some minor offense, which they do also. They could do something else with them.
I'd be curious from people from states other than Washington if you heard of hunting licenses going to the size of magazines.
Yeah.
I was going to say most. I don't know why hunting you need a 9, 10. There have been a number of attempts in various states.
At one time you had to have your shotgun in Wisconsin plugged for 3 cartridges.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, if you look at gun magazines, gun dealer things, I mean, there's so many. Here's how to convert your gun into fully automatic kit. I mean, it tells you how to do it. Illegal, of course, but they're apparently allowed to advertise and tell you how to do it or even buy things that would enable you to do it, though if you use it the way it's intended, you're breaking the federal law. I think you're right. I mean, I happen to think we ought to have a strict limit on the size of magazines you can use them. You don't need, I mean, a gun that's called the street sweeper is not something you use for deer hunting. And how many rounds you need at one time, I don't know.
You mentioned earlier that some of the foreign countries have stricter gun laws. Are you familiar with any of them? Are they radical?
Great Britain, I think, has a, well, here's a Canadian.
Can we have
one? Yeah, let's have one conversation, please.
Sure.
It's hard for people to hear and hear otherwise. Let's have one conversation. You're a Canadian. Were you going to?
No, I was just trying to hear what the conversation was.
The question was about foreign laws. I believe Great Britain has a total ban on handguns and for shooting, for sport shooting and so on. I think they are, I don't know how it works. I've never traveled there and tried to go sport shooting or anything, but I think you actually, they have gun clubs and so on where you can have, you don't privately own a handgun. And I don't know a lot about about laws in other countries. I do know that virtually every other country, industrialized country, they at least have a licensure and registration system. How many of them allow, Switzerland is one of the few that they require a licensure of it, but because of the nature of their country, every adult male is a member of the militia and has a gun. It's part of their culture, very much so, but they are strictly regulated. They're just, everybody has them.
Well, we used to have a lot of schools with gun clubs, shooting clubs, and they have been virtually eliminated. I don't know any now. There's a few private ones up in Connecticut there, but none of them pass the schools anymore. Yet that was a good education outlet to let people know what a gun is.
But I think people should be, kids have got to be aware of the danger and everything else of guns. And the more we refuse to talk about how we should regulate and require safety training or whatever everything else is, the more it's kind of dad's got this in his cabinet and I know where the key is and so on. I think we got to remember the responsibility people have to make sure that kids learn things. Yes, sir.
I'd be curious to know your thoughts on gun control and some of the so-called militias around.
And how you deal with the militias?
How you deal with the militias, and also partially how you define militias, and I'll tell you why.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, first of all, in terms of, you mean like militia-type organizations?
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that, first of all, any gun registration system like I'm proposing would not be well loved by them, and frankly, I have a feeling you'd have in terms of some of that, you'd have widespread violating of the law initially at least. And it's the same as with other things. I mean, you certain drugs that are illegal, it doesn't eliminate them, though frankly, somebody who has them in violation of the law, there is the ability to follow up because they had the illegal possession. I grew up in a town near Chicago where one of the hitmen from the Chicago crime syndicate used to live. I had a friend who delivered papers to the guy's house. I was scared silly when we heard it. I mean, in Chicago, they tell you, here's where so-and-so lives, and this is how the role they used to play in the crime syndicate. Near Cicero, yeah, very near there. Anyway, go ahead with a follow-up.
Well, the reason that I ask that is I'm a member of the Washington Civil War Association. As such, I'm a Civil War reenactor.
Mm-hmm.
And from time to time, there have been some movements and rumors and things that they're going to outlaw militias. And very broadly defined, that would take care of Washington Civil War Association. And my opinion is that black powder cap and ball weapons, muzzle loaders, usually aren't weapons of choice to go out
in high
school.
Muzzle loading.
One of my concerns is if you start looking at definitions and how you're going to do this and how you're going to do that, that people sometimes focus in on we are going to do away with this,
right.
But there's other perfectly legitimate things out
right.
there.
And I was going to say that I think in Eastern United States, there are a lot of Civil War reenactment groups and so on who do it regularly. And again, I don't know the details of every state. Using my state as an example only, we do treat historic firearms differently. And in my mind, there's a big difference also between Revolutionary War, Civil War era instruments and 1920s and 30s gangster type or World War I, World War II firearms, which it seems to me ought to be included in registration and everything else because of the very different nature of the weapons. Not saying people shouldn't have them and so on, and some of these things are extremely valuable. And collectors, people collect a lot weirder things than historic firearms. But you're right, I mean, muzzle-loading black powder weapons are not the kind of thing, they're not the gangster's weapon of choice.
It'll take a while to get that going.
Yeah.
I find it very disconcerting that confiscated guns by police departments somehow, through channels, find themselves back in the hands of a person like the one that committed the crimes down in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And they trace that serial number directly back to a police department who had confiscated it from someone else. How does the state of Minnesota deal?
We used to have, and I confess I can't remember what happened at the end of this year's session. It was batted back and forth. We used to have a ban on sale of confiscated weapons. And I don't know, there was law enforcement particularly, though there were a few rural sheriffs and so on who were arguing supporting it. Some of the gun lobby was arguing that they should be allowed to sell those. And I think your comments is exactly what I think a lot of people feel, and that is that, you know, even if they could make a few bucks selling these things, do we really want to
Melt them down?
And their argument is, well, somebody else is going to, they'll make a new gun. But I think most people, I think people who have been victims of gun violence, knowing that the guns that were used in cases like theirs can be resold and reused, I think is horrifying to a lot of people. In Minnesota, there was an attempt, as I said, to repeal it, and I don't know if it passed or not. I think in the end, maybe another Minnesotan remembers that, but I'm not sure what actually ended up happening. It was part of our bigger crime bill, and it got taken in, out, and put in again. And so, but the amount of money law enforcement would gain by doing that, I think, is minimal compared to the feeling of not just society at large, but particularly the victims.
I think it would be demoralizing to the average policeman to know that he's put himself and his life on the line to get
this gun, and now it's out there again.
Yeah. And for a sheer profit to then suddenly discover that it's back in the hands of
In Minnesota, again, we've treated gun, and again, I don't know how other states deal with this, but we, law enforcement is allowed to, we have a formula for who keeps the money for sport utility vehicles they confiscate, or snowmobiles, or other things. It's interesting, they tend to confiscate the ones that are, because there is a cost to forfeiture, legal cost to get it, and so they don't care to confiscate the junker cars as much as the...
So it doesn't go back into a widow's.
Nice one, But they do actually, they've actually used, I mean, this year we had a snowmobiler tracked down at 110 miles an hour, a police sheriff chased him down. Where did they get a snowmobile that could chase down something 510 miles an hour? Well, that was confiscated a year or two earlier, and the sheriff's department had this hot snowmobile. That came up during our snowmobile stud ban. Minnesota has interesting politics, as most of your states do. Yes?
In Minnesota, you can't carry a gun in a car unless it's unloaded and unless it's in a case. And North Koreans can't carry shells in a chamber. And I think this is a good law that slows down your hunting process.
Carry them in the magazine, not the chamber.
In North Dakota, you can carry them in the magazine.
Not in the magazine. You said chamber. Can't carry them in the chamber.
But you can also carry a gun out of the case in North Dakota where you can't in Minnesota.
So, in other words, in North Dakota, if you have a gun rack in the back of a pickup, you can carry a loaded.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's
in
Minnesota.
And then on the children, if you're 16 or under, you can hunt with the firearms permit. But you also have to have a guardian with you. You can't go alone.
I was going to guess also that in the Dakotas, Idaho, Montana, and lesser populated states, you're going to tend to have looser gun laws than you're going to have in more heavily populated communities. Mm-hmm. And partly because of the nature of how many people hunt, partly because of the nature of crime and violence. I mean, the bigger communities you have, the more crime you tend to have, and the more concern you have over gun violence.
Well, you're not a good old boy down south unless you've got a gun rack in your back window of the truck.
The stereotypical gun rack in the back of the pickup is there, yeah.
I think the biggest problem with a lot of these gun laws is basically who's batteries from. Because the biggest fear is, like you hit on earlier, that they start licensing guns, and then the next thing they do is take the guns away, you know. That fear is instilled in the people who own guns, the hunters, because of the do-gooders who are supporting these bills. You got the animal rights activists that are jumping on that bandwagon, you got the Sierra Club, you know. These are all people who, their ultimate goal is to ban hunting.
Yeah.
You know, and those are the people who support this type of legislation, and that's why it's fought so adamantly.
I understand. I mean, I think very clearly how much of it is people who want to ban all gun ownership who are pushing it versus something else. Well, I think one comment is I think that some of that is unjustified fear, partly because, again, the majority of gun owners support tighter gun laws. And the public at large strongly supports tighter gun laws, but if you start talking about confiscation of firearms and so on, I think you get very, very much tinier things. If you see the political difficulty of getting even something that has strong majority support for it, the idea that they're going to go further, in Minnesota they banned local governments from having stricter gun laws than statewide gun laws. Why? Oh, because somebody, because the cities might try and ban guns. Yeah, there's one city council member in Minneapolis 30 years ago who tried to ban handguns and didn't even get a second on his proposal, second on his motion. And yes, you can never guarantee. I mean, the same thing was said when people started licensing cars. You know, they might start someday, if they're going to register them and license you, they might someday take away your right to drive. They could. We still could do that. But politically, there's a lot more support for registration and other, what I'd call some basic gun laws, than there is for the idea of confiscating them. But you can't guarantee. I can't tell you that people, the legislature is allowed to do one now. They'd be allowed to confiscate guns 50 years from now, even if we didn't do registration now. You can't guarantee what the future holds that way. And you're right, some people who want registration want to ban every gun, and most don't.
There was, some time ago, there was something went on. I don't remember which thing it was. There have been so many, but they discovered there were a lot of guns shipped into the country. Where was it, from China or something? Now, yeah, we can't, I mean, you know, if they're going to come in, under the noses of the importers, we can't ban that sort of thing because we don't know they're coming in.
We do ban most, somebody else might know more, but we do ban most foreign...
Well, I shouldn't say ban, I should say that they can come in illegally.
Yeah.
And this is what we can't. We can't.
By the way, I noticed somebody's getting ready to get up. It is 6 o'clock and yeah, about time for dinner. I'm going to officially end it here, but I'm happy to stay around and talk a little bit more until dinner.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.